Hello, my friends. This is Life Coach Mike Trugman, and welcome to an episode of Mike's Search for Meaning. I'm after some big questions. Why are we here? What makes a fulfilling life? How can we grow individually and collectively? Each episode, I'll dive deep with leaders who are doing great work in the world and see how they organize their life. Books read, value systems, resources used, and stories that show how each of you can create the life and the world of your dreams. Welcome to, or welcome back to, episode 111 of the Mike's Search for Meaning podcast. My guest today is a personal hero of mine, Seth Godin. Seth is a best-selling author. My favorite of his books is Linchpin. He's also the author of The Dip, Purple Cow, and What to Do When It's Your Turn, and It's Always Your Turn, among several other books. This was the most nervous I was to conduct an interview in a very long time because of how much I admire and look up to Seth. And he's probably most known for being an entrepreneur, a teacher, and a marketing expert. But what I'm most drawn to about Seth is that he really sees the highest potential in people. And I personally encountered Seth in 2019 at a time where I really didn't feel like I mattered much in my professional life. When I came across Linchpin, which I discuss at the end of this conversation, I pay homage to Seth and tell him how much he has impacted me. So you're definitely going to want to stay tuned at the end there for my share. Seth really woke me up to how much I matter and how much every person matters. One touching story, which we get into in this conversation, is the impact that one woman at 7-Eleven who worked at 7-Eleven for a long time had on many people, and that we don't need to, or rather even it would behoove us to not give any power to our job title when it comes to doing meaningful and hard work. And one of the most important things that we can control in our life is how we interact with other people. We always have a choice with how we show up to our life. Whether you are a coder, an accountant, an entrepreneur, a truck driver, whatever you do, there is an energy that you can bring that affects the other people that you are around. And in 2019, I was just being exposed to this idea for the first time. I felt that as a lower level employee at a big corporate company, that I didn't have really any autonomy or any say. And there were actually days that I would go into work and not say a single word to another person. There were days that I didn't even feel that I had the courage to go up to another person and interact with them. And this is the real power of Seth's work, is that he can ignite this spark in all of us, that we all in some ways want to take responsibility for our impact. And we all want to see the good in people. At least this is the way that I experience Seth. And he's really good at also parsing through the things that get in our way, the systems that are in a lot of ways blocking us, things like capitalism, industrialization, the ways that these systems make it so that we get scared from doing the human things. And so we talk about what it means to dance with our resistance, the lizard brain. These are all, if you're familiar with Seth's work already, these are all things that you've probably heard him speak about a million times, but that feel really important. And we get a little bit into the way that change actually happens at the margins these days, that trying to appeal to the masses or thinking that a politician is solely responsible for creating change is outdated at best, that grassroots movements are created at the margins, at the fringes, by finding your smallest viable audience. So we'll get into all of this and more in this conversation. A couple of things before I hand it over to Seth. Every episode, I donate to and raise awareness for an organization of my guest choice. And Seth has selected the organization Climate Central, which we talk a little bit about at the end of the episode as well. Seth, with hundreds of other people around the world, recently contributed to a book. I didn't say authored. He contributed to a book because it's co-authored with hundreds of other people, called The Carbon Almanac, which highlights the problem, the existential problem of climate change, and how we can turn it around, how we can face the imminent, if we don't intervene, extinction of our species and turn climate change around. So Climate Central is doing really powerful work in this arena. I'll link to all the ways you can connect with Seth as well. He is a prolific blogger, a prolific creator. There's all sorts of different things that Seth has put out there that I'll link to in the show notes as well. And lastly, if you think this show is really good, please share it with a friend. Please leave a review, whether it's on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, whatever platform you are tuned in on. It really makes a big difference in this show finding the right people. With all of that said, settle in, take a deep breath, and enjoy this powerful conversation with the one and only Seth Godin. All right, Seth, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike. If you find some meaning, let me know, because everyone's looking for it.
I appreciate that. So we met no more than, 15 seconds ago, and we're jumping right in here because I think this is the way I lead here. So I was just saying to you, I'm really nervous to interview you. And what I would attribute that to is there's a couple of things. There's a perfectionist in me who's like, I need to be impressive to Seth. I need to give him the best experience. He's been on so many shows before. Also, if I give Seth this amazing experience, then lots of other people are going to find out about me. And I'm falling into the trappings of what you so eloquently speak to about winning the lottery or hitting a home run, finding the millions of people who were waiting for me. Could you speak to what I am speaking to right now?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is you don't hear from your listeners as often as you should, who point out how grateful they are for what you do, for showing up regularly, for leaning into something with possibility. And because we don't hear from them, it's easy to imagine it's not there, but it's there. And the second thing is the feelings that you're feeling, Steve Pressfield calls it resistance, that happens. You can't make it go away. The real issue is it useful? Is it helpful to feel that? If it is, lean into it because it will escalate the quality of what you do. If it's not helpful, then we can simply acknowledge that it's there and go back to work. And this idea of go back to work is critical. So I've spoken at TED a bunch of times. And one of the things they do in the 20 minutes before you go on stage is they do all these things to make you extra nervous. And I don't think that's helpful. And I'm going to do a much better job if I can just show up and do my work. So we can approach this as professionals. And we can say to ourselves, the feelings are the feelings. And I can't do anything to make them go away, but I can dance with them. Because the harder we push to make them go away, the harder they're going to stick around.
Mm-hmm. So I'll dive into another trap that I fall into. I might go, a listener might go, that's really easy for Seth Godin to say. Seth is such a talented speaker. I mean, I get that he's a human and he gets nervous, but I get way more nervous than Seth. My resistance is way stronger than Seth's. And maybe you could bring us closer to, is it true that you paid for the first 100 speeches that you gave or professional speeches that you gave?
Well, paid means that my company worked to get me to speak for free. So we would sponsor an event or we would reach out to people or we would put things into the world because I started one of the first internet companies and we were competing against companies that had millions and millions of dollars in the bank. We did not. So we couldn't run the ads and the conferences that they could run. We decided the best way to get the word out was me to stand up and teach people what I knew. So yeah, after the 50th or 100th speech, when someone reached out and said, what's your fee? I was like, what? There's a fee? What's your fee? Does that mean I have to pay you? And so I just made up a number and they said, okay. And that was the last time then you cross the line and you're in the professional business. But, to the person who says, well, but you're Seth Godin, I would remind them that the first 100 blog posts no one read and I've had more books rejected than anybody you know. Mm-hmm. And on a regular basis, ideas that I bring to the world don't work. And for me, it could be a trap. where the stakes feel higher, right? If I was unknown, when I show up to do something in a space where no one knows my work, then the stakes are lower and it's actually easier because if I screw up, it doesn't really matter.
What, like when I started this podcast, and I would love to talk about Akimbo workshops and Alt MBA at some point, because I think that you're masterful at creating the conditions for people to step into, say, speech number one or blog post number one. What was guiding you for speech number one, blog post number one? Like what incentives did you create for yourself to keep going when no one was listening?
So I think what's useful, because my personal experience isn't relevant. What's relevant is your personal experience. What's useful? What's useful for me is to realize that sometimes we have to do things because it's our job. And sometimes we get to do things because we can. And I find it's helpful to view those things as an art project. What you do when you're making an art project is you're not saying, this better show up at MoMA or it's not worth me making. This better be a bestseller. It's not worth me doing. The magic of an art project is to say, I have something to share. This is how I think I could share it. I'm going to try to do something generous here. Here we go. And if we can be light when we do that, for me anyway, it makes our work better, not worse. I don't want a surgeon who thinks that way. I would like a surgeon to think that it's sort of life and death, because it is. But if I'm getting go to the trouble of showing up somewhere and giving a speech, I'm not giving it to hear what I have to say. I could hear what I have to say at home. I'm showing up because I have something I think other people might want to hear. Mm-hmm. And so I'm there for them. And that requires empathy, because the people you are doing your art project for don't know what you know, don't see what you see, don't want what you want. And we have to be able to say, that's okay, and lean into what we can do with that.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to pivot a little bit here. And thank you. This was really helpful. The first 5 minutes or so, I feel a lot more settled. And we'll see where the conversation
goes. Hot out of the box. Here we go.
So I don't think I've ever heard anyone ask you this question. And typically, I lead off my interview by asking what it was like at your dinner table when you were growing up. And I'm interested in I'll let you answer the question first, and then we'll see. There's a few different directions I might want to go.
I think that's a good question. I don't want to answer it because I've worked very hard to talk about other people and not about me. So I won the birthday lottery. I had amazing parents, but no one had my parents other than my sisters. So it's not really helpful in the sense of that person's like that because of so-and-so. Yeah. I mean, in biography, that's fun to read, but that's not going to help you do your work. Mm-hmm. And my sisters have said to me, we heard that interview you did where we believe you, but we grew up in the same house you did, and that's not our experience. And I think that's the key, is we get to choose the narrative we have about the experience we had. Two people growing up in the same house, two people who were in the same social or caste situation, two people who were here. What story do you tell yourself about that? And is it helpful? And if it's not helping you get what you seek to get, stop reminding yourself of the story. Because, you know, I mean, I'm guessing that Viktor Frankl had something to do with the name of your podcast. And
of course,
people should reread that book every year. Because the fact is, something absolutely inhumane and cruel and horrible and pathological happened to him and millions of other people. And there is no justice in it. But then what are you going to do with it? Then what is the story you're going to tell? And I think that's what's interesting.
Such a fascinating answer to that, non-answer to that question, but a really beautiful one. And yes, of course, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning is the namesake of this podcast. That's where I created it from. So we could actually speak about purpose here, because I think that this is another trapping that we might fall into as a culture, is that we need to find purpose. And what you're alluding to here by not answering that question is that we get to make the meaning, we get to write our own story about what happens to us, even if we are in circumstances like the Holocaust. So could you speak to how you look at purpose and choosing to love what you do not the other way around, like finding something that you need to love.
Yeah, it's really recent that this whole find what you love and do that mantra became popular. I mean, work for 10,000 years was the thing you did to feed your family, not the thing you did to feed your soul. And only recently did we get to work indoors and in an Aeron chair and to type and things like that. The search for purpose feels narcissistic to me. And it also feels like a way to avoid resistance. Right? I'm just not in the, this is not authentic. I'm not in the mood. I can't find my way through this. Well, it's so much easier. It's so much more useful to be able to say, I am going to choose to love what I do, not to do what I love. And those are totally different ways to be in the world. And so, yeah, I made a decision a very long time ago that the conditions for authors matched my personality. I had a chance to be in the movie business. I had a chance to be in the theater business. I had a chance to be in the making spreadsheets for nursing homes business. And each one of them brought conditions with it. Sometimes more fame or more money, sometimes more stability, whatever it is. Go find a place where the conditions line up to how you'd like to spend your day. But then you're in it, and your purpose might just simply be in this thing I'm in. How do I show up in a way that I am proud of? How do I change the system in generative ways? How do I be missed if I'm gone? And if we simply do that, we can drop the narrative and get back to work. And it's the work that creates the next narrative. Mm-hmm.
Could you speak to the art is something that you speak really beautifully about. And it really changed. Maybe let me backtrack a little. My background is in accounting. Accounting, when I first encountered your work, it was very easy to feel like I was a helpless cog mm-hmm. in the industrial machine, right? Accounting is a very replicable year on year, the tasks are not all that different. Maybe you're learning a couple of new skills here and there, but especially at the level I was at in my early 20s, I really felt like a helpless cog, that my humanity felt like it was being stripped away. And you've told really beautiful stories about people who have seemingly no autonomy in, you know, say, working at a 7-Eleven or I don't know, even a truck driver, you know, so people that are doing things that you would go, what, there's no way that I could show up as an artist or be generous or show my genius there. Is there a story that comes to mind for, you know, someone who seemingly is a cog in the machine who shows up that way as an artist?
So the 7-Eleven story, the last time I told it was a few years ago, so I'll get all the details wrong. But I recall reading about a woman who was retiring after 20 or 30 years working the cash register at the local 7-Eleven and how many people came to say goodbye and how she had made a difference in their life. Because the fact is that you have at home everything you need to make a cup of coffee or to grab a Coke out of the fridge. You're going to the 7-Eleven for a whole bunch of reasons, but only one of them is to get a thing you don't have. And for the people who came every morning, and I met a woman like this just last week at a 7-Eleven type place, and I talked to her for 20 minutes. She decided that she was going to be the mayor of her little section of the world and that she was going to make every single person's day a little bit better when she saw them. And she benefited more from that than they did because she was able to create the conditions where they brought their best selves. So she was spending her whole day making people less grumpy and having people come in already less grumpy because they knew that she was there. Mm-hmm. So when you said you were an accountant, what I leaped to is there's a difference between a bookkeeper who's isolated from the customer and an accountant. A great accountant asks hard questions, comes up with new conceptions, produces work that is more accurate, more insightful, and more useful. That is not easy to do. And yes, you have to pay your dues by understanding the clerical part of it. But all of this keeps coming down to, do you get to interact with another human? Do you get to interact with a system that can hear you and respond to what you do? Even if you spend your whole day architecting a website, how can you do it in a way that the person who touches that website feels different than if it had been built by someone other than you. Mm. So if you really have no degrees of freedom in your daily job, zero, tell me why you stay in that job. Because freedom is the privilege of owning our work, the privilege of being able to innovate and discover what happens next. Why would you want to live a life without freedom? And maybe you say, because I'm doing it for the money. Great. How much money do you need to make doing that before you'll stop? But to sacrifice our freedom at that level, where we don't even get to make art in our work, I don't know why anyone would do that.
We've been dancing around it a little bit, and I know you've spoken about this in a bunch of other conversations, and it's all over your work everywhere. But could you speak a little bit to the systems that, like, I was sitting with this question of why it's getting less and less hard for me, and I do my best to really show up generously and as a human in every interaction that I have. And it used to be really hard for me to do that. Could you speak to, in your view, based on your studying of all the systems that we are operating in, what makes it so challenging? Why are we so scared to be human?
Well, I think the biggest system is the system of evolutionary biology. How did we get here? And then the cultural evolution of tribes of 150 people, nomadic tribes, hunter-gatherers, then farmers, then ranchers, then factory owners, all of which is about how do you have great children and grandchildren, all of which is which cultures survive. And the fact is, if you're in the village of 150 people and you badmouth the chief and they throw you out of the village, you're going to get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. That it is very easy to see how in a group of 150 people, an extended family, there are hierarchies, there are status roles, there is this idea that you have to think hard before you upset the social structure. Then we add to it the leverage that a machine has, the leverage that a factory owner has, the leverage that capitalism brings to the table. And that leads to a cultural dynamic of public school, which says, will this be on the test? How do I comply? How do I do as little as I can to get away with it? If I speak up too much, the bully's going to punch me in the face. If I'm the class clown, I'm going to go to the principal's office. But if I can get the certificate, then I can get a job where people tell me what to do. It's high school for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And so that's the system we built. We built it because it used to work. And what happened is, because of communications, because of mass production shifting, because of the container ship and 10,000 other things, that's no longer an effective way to ensure your success or your happiness. And so we have all this brainwashing that says, I'm an imposter. I better not speak up. How do I stay out of trouble? Will this be on the test? How do I follow? Who's my manager? Figure out how to take a deep breath and say, well, yeah, but our meaning lies in leading, connecting, being generous, being generative, taking care of the people around us, none of which they teach at Harvard Business School. Mm-hmm. And so that is our challenge.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a little bit into how you might create the conditions for someone to learn how to do these things. Like they're what we're talking about was incredibly novel to me. I never thought of myself as an entrepreneur or someone who had creative capacity. And I guess one of the things that I'm so passionate about or that I want to bring to the show is that I want to awaken this. And if I can do it, anyone can do it. I really felt like I had zero ability. In 2018, if you told me I'd be interviewing you, I would have crapped my pants, I think. Even just at the thought of it, it just didn't seem possible that it would happen. And so I'm curious about how you create the conditions. Maybe actually I'll speak a little bit about one of the workshops I did with you. That this podcast is actually here because of an Akimbo workshop. And you broke down the steps of a podcast into, I guess, what is the very first thing that someone who creates a podcast needs to focus on? And I remember, I don't know if this was the first exercise, but I had to just record anything out loud for a minute. just take out my phone, record for a minute something, a summary of my day, a thought I was having, whatever. And that was really hard. I had a really hard time just allowing myself to speak for a minute without filtering it for, is this going to sound stupid? What am I doing? So how do you create the conditions so that, or how do you look at creating conditions so that people aren't doing the outdated, antiquated, old system? Someone's going to tell me what to do. Someone's going to tell me how to do it. Stepping into, I can create my own experience here, right? Like that I solve interesting problems. I can lead. I can be generous.
That's a great question. For folks who are listening, Akimbo and the Alt MBA are no longer mine. I don't run them. I just want to make that clear. We spun them off as a B Corp, and the people I used to work with run them as separate entities. But what you're talking about, part of it was inspired by a family friend who had been an actor since he was 6. And when he went to college, he applied for the improv troupe at a fairly well-known college. And 11 people got in, and he was ranked 12th. And he was crestfallen. And I said, start your own improv troupe. You don't need a building. You don't need a permit. You don't need money. What? He couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. And the irony, of course, is it's improv. So that's where we get stuck. We get stuck because we have lived with the conditions of, I need approval. I need somebody to tell me what to do. And the method is super simple, which you already told us. What's the smallest useful unit of shift, right? Everyone can record 1 minute of talking, and there is clearly no downside. Everyone can start a blog using free software under another name. There is clearly no downside. It's not your name. You could blog every day for a month. If no one reads it, no one reads it. If a lot of people read it, a lot of people read it, but no one will know you wrote it. And so why haven't you done that? You haven't done it because first steps are really hard. And if it's important to you to have a voice, figure out the smallest possible first step. Don't give a speech at TED. Give a speech to your dog. Right. And if you're not willing to give a speech to your dog, stop whining about it and realize you don't want to give a speech. That's fine. Totally fine. It's the whining that's the problem.
Do you believe that that's innate in every person that we want to give us that, you know, that we have something to say, that we want to create change? Or do you think that it's still useful to have some people who just want to be told what to do, need to be led, don't have agency, autonomy, etc.?
Well, those are two different questions. Clearly, it's still useful for people to be willing cogs in the machine. We need the machine. There's electricity here in my office because someone who didn't feel like going to work today made sure that Con Ed didn't go down, right? We all benefit from that. And that's why it persists. Your question about is it innate? Then we get very complicated questions about nature and nurture and stuff. Worth noting that perfect pitch was long believed to be something that was biological. It's a talent, not a skill. Perfect pitch is someone presses a note on the piano and you know what note it is. You can sing that note without any prep. Well, it turns out that because Chinese is a song language, there are far more people in China with perfect pitch than in any other country as a percentage. And you say, well, sure, because folks evolved because of the language, blah, blah, blah. Well, it turns out first generation immigrants to the United States from China who have kids here, their kids are just as likely to have perfect pitch as people who come from different parts of the world. So in fact, it's growing up speaking a language that's sung makes it more likely that this thing will come out. It is both biological and taught. If we ask a kindergarten class, and I've done this, walk into a kindergarten class of 20 kids and say, raise your hand if you're an artist, almost every single kid raises their hand. And if you go into an eighth grade class and do it, almost nobody raises their hand. So I believe that kindergartners want to tell the joke, finger paint, do something that's new. And I believe we have boiled it out of people as they grow up.
Is this still something that you contend with? I know you don't want to answer questions about yourself, but I think it's useful for the listeners. I've heard you talk about the Carbon Almanac and say that there was still, I forget the exact way you said it, but that you in some way you felt stupid, like not, you didn't know what you were talking about there. And to me, that I could point to the way that that's resistance speaking for you, that you didn't feel that you had a worthy voice to speak in that arena until you accumulated enough knowledge or something like that. So is this something that still shows up for you? How do you meet your resistance and say whatever you need to say to it? It's maybe a cognitive behavioral thing or whatever you might do.
The Almanac example wasn't about resistance. It was simply about developing a skill. But in general, if I'm not feeling resistance, I'm not working hard enough. Mm-hmm. It's like you had a workout, but you didn't get tired, then you didn't work out hard enough. The whole purpose of running a marathon is to get tired. The whole purpose of creative work is to feel resistance. If you don't feel resistance, you're not trying hard.
That's a beautiful insight and yet another trapping that I fall into, that someday, if I've done enough work on myself, all this goes away. The work just gets easy. You know, that's just what's going to happen over time.
No, when you build a reputation, the marketing gets easier, right? Mm-hmm. That going from 1,000 listeners of your podcast to 2,000 is much easier than going from 0 to 1,000. Mm-hmm. Because that's not about resistance. That's about marketing. It gets easier. But the next project, you know, I mean, I'm guessing that, you know, when Earl Stanley Gardner was one of the best-selling writers of all time in the world, he wrote the Perry Mason novels. He wrote a Perry Mason novel every 3 weeks. He dictated it to a secretary and not a word was edited when he was done. And I think the first couple of Perry Mason novels were probably hard. And then after that, it wasn't hard because Perry Mason novel number 5 does not break very much new ground. There's no resistance on offer here. And I'm glad he wrote the Perry Mason novels, but it's not art after you invent the genre and you keep repeating it, you're not extending yourself. You're not taking a risk, and therefore there is no resistance. Mm-hmm.
So marketing, something that we haven't spoken about. I mean, that's really your claim to fame. Could you speak about the smallest viable audience? I know that you've spoken about it a bunch, but this is something that I think it makes a lot of sense once you hear it. And it's also, I've been blind to it for most of my life. It's just—
Everyone has. That's why I have to keep talking about it. Because even after I explain it to people and they agree with me, they go back to ignoring it.
Myself included, yeah.
We grew up in a world of network television. Network television, there's 3 channels. If there's 3 channels, that means that every night, ABC gets 1/3 of the audience as a given. It's theirs to win or lose. And the way you get promoted is to earn a percent, not lose a percent. So the entire mindset is make sure there are no critics, make sure you haven't disappointed everybody, and get the biggest possible audience. That there's a list in the newspaper every week, the New York Times bestseller list. It's not a list of the most interesting books published this week. It's not a list of the books we think you should read. It's a list of the best-selling books. And it doesn't matter if they're banal. It doesn't matter if they're forgettable. It matters that someone made the list. And so there's all this pressure to reach the largest possible audience. Turns out, the single best way for anything to succeed, for anything to make a difference, a restaurant, a book, a movie, a piece of software, is to be specific, not general. To begin with the smallest viable audience, it might not be relatively small, but it's the smallest one that can sustain you, the smallest one that's worth addressing. And ignore everyone else, right? You've already ignored everybody in Croatia. You've already ignored everybody in, you know, Botswana who doesn't speak English. You already made the decision that your podcast is just for the percentage of people on earth who can listen to a podcast and speak English. So now you need to go 5 steps further because you're not competing with a true crime show and you shouldn't act like you are. It should be for people who want this, this is this. And the more specific you can be, the scarier it is. Because what you're saying is, if you didn't like what I said I made, you really didn't like it because I made what I said I was going to make and you didn't like it. I'm on the hook. But I believe being on the hook is the best place to be. Mm-hmm.
And could you speak to the way that this creates change in a way, given the world that we currently live in, that these are the types of ripples that create change and not the waiting on the president or someone that's high up at Harvard or et cetera, for them to be the one that says, all right, we're changing the education system, we're changing capitalism. Like how does the smallest viable audience create
well,
the change?
So, let's just look at any change that we care about. Where did, new thinking in philosophy come from? It didn't come from a tenured professor at Harvard. Where did OpenAI and LLMs come from? It didn't come from Microsoft. They had to get in after the fact. Where did the smartphone come from? It didn't come from Apple Computer, right? Where did social networking come from? It didn't come from Yahoo. So when we think about large organizations, esteemed organizations, they almost never go first. They almost never come up with an innovation that makes things better. Sometimes in their goal to be persistent and big, they grab it as soon as they can, but they are in a different business. And so it's very easy, when we think about my friend Simon Sinek's TED talk, he didn't give that talk on the TED main stage, and neither did Brené Brown. They gave those talks at a TEDx because they couldn't get picked by the TED team. They were in Houston or somewhere. And then it spread, and then it spread, and then it spread. So you don't have to get picked if you want to make music, if you want to give a speech, if you want to write a book, if you want to come up with software. There are very few things left where getting picked is essential. Instead, it's starting with the smallest unit of innovation and changing somebody, being worth it. That's hard, but there's no one stopping you from doing it.
Where would you attribute I think part of what makes you stand out above anyone else who's got lots of maybe a contrarian or people who are able to pick apart and dissect the system and say it's effed, is that you fundamentally believe in people and you believe, you seem like an eternal optimist who's also got his finger on the pulse of what's really going on. And it's very refreshing. So where would you attribute your optimism, your love of humans, love of humanity from?
Well, we started by talking about strategies, and optimism is a strategy. Simon and I agree about this. Given the choice between being an optimist and a pessimist, it seems like being an optimist is more likely to get you what you want. It's more likely to lead to the outcomes you seek. So I had to train myself to see things through that lens because that's the best way I know to solve problems. The climate thing is really trying my optimism because the systems around us seem like they're working as hard as they can to destroy everything. But if I'm not going to be optimistic about this, then I'm going to be paralyzed. And I'd rather do something than cower in fear and gloom, because it's only when we coordinate, do something, lead, that things get better. So I know it's tempting to say, well, that person was born an optimist. But I wasn't born an optimist. I don't think most people are. I was just thoughtful about which posture I chose to adopt. Mm-hmm.
So, Seth, I wish I had you for another hour, but I want to make sure that I am timely. I know that we're only booked for another 10 minutes. And I always raise awareness for an organization of guest choice. You gave me a bevy of options, but I'm going with Climate Central. And so if you could speak to Climate Central and maybe with a little bit of tie-in around the Carbon Almanac and what you've been working on, maybe a couple of things for people to pay attention to in the climate crisis that we're in.
Sure. I'm tempted to not call it a crisis because crises come and go. This is more of a chronic condition. There are no cancer deniers, right? And that's because it's visible and urgent and a tragedy. And we have a similar problem with what's going on with the climate. So I spent a year and a half of my life organizing this as a full-time volunteer. I didn't get paid, neither did any of the 1,900 people who have been working on the project. It's a 97,000-word, footnoted, illustrated, sourced almanac, and we hadn't found a significant error in the entire book, even though it was built in 5 months by volunteers. And one of the things that we found, we found many organizations are working on it, is a group called Climate Central. And what they figured out is that weather people, meteorologists, the person who stands in front of the map on the nightly news, are trusted. Even though they're wrong a lot about the weather tomorrow, they tend to be correct about the weather right now. And this group of people has the authority and the insight to be able to talk about the climate. So, for example, the weather is what it's like right now. The wind chill factor says the temperature is X, but it feels like Y because it's windy out. And the wind chill factor is a fairly recent occurrence in terms of communicating the weather. Well, what's the carbon factor? Meaning, compared to what the weather would have been like without climate change, how much of what we're experiencing right now is due to the shift in the climate? If we can teach meteorologists how to talk eloquently about what's happening to the climate, we will reach a lot of people. And that's what Climate Central does in a really effective, highly leveraged way. There are meteorologists on their board and they're connected. So it's not going to change the whole world, but this is brick by brick by brick. That's what's happening. What we need to do for the climate is very simple. It is not about you recycling plastic bottles, because in fact, they can't be recycled. It is not about your carbon footprint, because in fact, that was made up by British Petroleum as a way to make us feel like hypocrites. What we can do about the environment is change the system. And the way to change the system is to charge a fair price for carbon. When we charge a fair price for carbon, for what it should cost, when we stop subsidizing beef, then we'll make better decisions. And the magic of a market is we tend to make better decisions when we know the truth. And so the reason that the Carbon Almanac exists, and you can find all sorts of free resources, a photo book, a kid's book, footnotes at thecarbonalmanac.org. The reason it exists is so that we can see and talk about it. And if you're not talking about it, it's not going to get better.
And very quickly, a fair price on carbon would be something like, if I make the choice to fly from New York to California, that it would be significantly more expensive than it currently is, right? Or to drive.
Yeah. So what happens right now is a billionaire decides to take a jet from New York to London to go to a play. That costs about $85,000. But it costs the rest of us hundreds of thousands of dollars. We didn't get to go on the plane, but we're all paying for that person to take the plane. So what should happen? There's some organizations that are talked about in the book. This is my position, not the team's position. But what should happen, I believe, is simple. We should charge a fair price for that flight to London. If you want to go, that's fine. And then distribute the cash to every single person in the country. And the government doesn't touch a penny. So I think that flight should cost $480,000 because that's an accurate reflection of what it costs all of us. That's $400,000 extra, which would then go to everybody in a check. And over time, you'd get lots of checks in from people who are doing things with carbon that you're choosing not to. And the things would keep going up so that people would make better choices. And all of a sudden, when things cost what they're supposed to cost, people choose to buy things differently.
Beautiful. So I'll make sure to link to Climate Central and Carbon Almanac and all the places that people can connect with you in the show notes. And the final question that I ask in every interview, Seth, what does it mean to you to live a meaningful life?
You know, I like to say, go make a ruckus. And that doesn't mean go be a jerk or go be annoying. It means go find a system where you can make a contribution to make things better than when you got there, to be missed if you were gone. I feel like if you can spend your whole life doing that generative work, that's pretty meaningful.
Well, Seth, thank you so much for joining me. I wanted to give a couple of minutes at the end to acknowledge you because you've really impacted my life. And there's two specific ways. One is Lynchpin, the book itself, just really, in a lot of ways, it grabbed me by the collar at a time that I didn't feel like I could make a meaningful difference. And I was just, in a lot of ways, sleepwalking through my life. Like I would go to work, there were days that I just wasn't even talking to or interacting with another person, that I was just plugged to my screen. And luckily there was a quiet part of me that wanted to wake up to the fact that I could take responsibility for my impact. And Lynchpin came my way at a time where I really needed it. And I know a lot of people have been impacted by that book, and you did a really beautiful job there breaking down just what are the different things at play? What are the systems? Why are you feeling fear of all the things, public speaking, all the other things that you're feeling fear around? And it really woke me up to take responsibility. And your workshop at Akimbo, there was actually a time that I'd signed up. I might have been a few days into it. And I wrote this really lengthy post that I was overwhelmed. I didn't think I was going to make it through the course. And something I've heard you speak to is that, you know, the impact that you want to have is that you taught some people who taught some other people. And while you were not physically there, you didn't do anything to help me stay in the course. Something about the container that was created had people step up and say, Mike, I've been there. You're not alone. The overwhelm you're feeling, the not enoughness you're feeling, I feel that too. And I want to encourage you to keep going. And without all of the different times you've stepped up and taught and grappled with resistance in your life, I wouldn't be sitting here right now. So I just want to salute you, appreciate you. This was really a dream come true to sit down with you for 45 minutes and interview you.
Thank you, Mike. That means a lot to me. You've changed my day. I appreciate that.
So to everyone who is listening, and we didn't get to Icarus, but my wish to you is don't fly too low. I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day or evening. Take good care, and sending you lots of love.
Go make a ruckus. Thanks.
Go make a ruckus. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to Mike's Search for Meaning. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, share this episode with your friends, and leave a review. I look forward to seeing you next time, my friends. And until then, stay safe, stay well, and keep living with purpose. Thank you.